Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to take a journey to the Baltimore Book Festival this half hour in a number of different forms. We start off, we'll be meeting, of course, this is Wednesday, which means we have our segment with City Paper, and that the whole paper's about the book festival. We're talking to Baynard Woods about that, but we start off with Wayne Carlin. Wayne Carlin is a dear friend of mine. He is somebody who co-produced our series, Shared Weight, which is about bringing Vietnamese, Vietnam War veterans together with Vietnamese war veterans in Vietnam, looking at the artists born of war and more, and produced an incredible series called Wandering Souls. And he wrote the book Wandering Souls, Journeys with the Dead and Living in Vietnam. He's the author of numerous books like Marble Mountain, War Movies, Journeys to Vietnam, Wish for Country, Prisoners, Rumors, and Stones. Crossover, he edited The Other Side of Heaven, post-war fiction by Vietnamese-American writers, and many of the Vietnam veterans who have become writers really think of Wayne in many ways as the dean of Vietnam War veteran writers. And he joins us now to talk about what he's going to be doing at the book festival. Wayne, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Always good to have you with us, man. So, and Wayne, by the way, as we hear this conversation unfold, will be at the book festival Friday night, 5 to 6 p.m., Friday, September 23rd at the Ivy Bookshop stage. It's all taking place down across from the Inner Harbor. But Wayne, so you're going to kind of talk about your body of work that night, right?
Yeah, for what the communication I got yesterday actually is that the bookstore wants me to speak mostly about Wandering Souls. I will speak about that book, which you know quite well.
Yes, well, Wandering Souls, we can tell folks stories. Some people have not heard. We've played this series numerous times, and we'll be playing it again. But this is a story, was a really remarkable story, because we were on our way to Vietnam to do this documentary series when you brought up what happened when you had an interaction with another Vietnam vet trying to find... he had in possession the diary of a man he had killed in Vietnam, the first person that he shot and killed in Vietnam as a soldier, and the journey was to find the family of the man he killed.
Right. In a lot of ways, that story in that book was a kind of culmination of a lot of different threads and themes, I guess, in the work that I've been trying to do as a writer and then as an editor, in the sense of bringing in the voices, the experiences, the lives of American veterans and veterans of the other side, the people who try to kill each other, and as an act of reconciliation, that act of knowing each other's stories and being able to reflect the common humanity that we had, the common damages of war. It's been a real motivating factor for me. So with Wandering Souls, when my friend Homer Steedley contacted me about having these documents, these notebooks from a guy that he had met on a trail face-to-face and shot and killed, he just shot a little quicker than Hoang Nhuc Dam, who was the soldier for the North Vietnamese Army that he killed. And 35 years later, Homer, dealing with PTSD, dealing with a lot of things from the war, was urged by his wife to kind of look back into his past. And when he did, he came across these documents he'd taken from the body and that he'd put out of his mind. And he knew I'd been doing this work with people from Vietnam, so he asked me to try to find the family of this person and return the documents. And of course, we were there when we went back to Vietnam after we had located the family. The soldier turned out to be a North Vietnamese medic, Hoang Nhuc Dam, who came from a small village in North Vietnam, farming village. And in finding the family then bringing back documents to them, what I found was there's so many similarities between the lives of the man who killed him and the man who was killed that it reflected so many stories in that way. They were both farm kids. They both came from families that always, you know, volunteered for the military. They were both young, patriotic, and you know, when it cost his life, literally, and the person who killed him, it cost him many years of his life in dealing, not just with that death, but you know, all the deaths and traumas of the war.
You know, you've gone back and forth to Vietnam a lot, and we've done a lot of work with Vietnamese writers, people who have fought in the war. And the Vietnam War, or as they say in Vietnam, the American War. And the thing that really struck me, you said this to me years ago, and you've written it numerous times, you wrote it again, I think, in the introduction to a book that you'll be bringing out in November, in the life of this Vietnamese filmmaker, who I met with you in Vietnam, Tran Van Thuy. Just talk about this before while we have time together today, and we'll do a much longer segment when the book comes out in November, and we get into this in a deeper way. But you wrote, you know, when you call him your brother An in Vietnamese, and you write here, he says, I came to know that we had been in certain places at certain times when we literally had the opportunity to kill each other or at least watch each other's deaths with satisfaction or indifference. The realization I would have wasted, as we called killing during the war, not only these people I had come to cherish, but also the books that one of them came to write and the films the other one came to create, left me an ache of grief as if I had really killed them. I mean, and the realization, I mean, it just, I mean, that forms so much of a core of kind of what pushes you in the work you do.
Yeah, and I was writing in that passage about two people, two friends in Vietnam. One is a woman who is now a, you know, well-known writer and had been a volunteer on the Ho Chi Minh trails during the war. The other, as you said, the filmmaker, Tran Van Thuy, who had been a cameraman in the North Vietnamese Army. And they both told me how terrified they were of the American helicopters in particular. And I'd been a helicopter gunner. So I had this kind of, you know, it's more than a realization. It's almost a very strong, life-changing vision in meeting both these people. You know, and looking at short distances across their faces after we'd become friends, that seeing them the way I would have seen them during the war, which is simply as targets, you know, as threats to me, and understanding when they were looking at me, they were looking at me in the same way. And you know, we didn't see them as human beings. They were targets. They were threats. And to get to know them afterwards, to you know, have that kind of visionary experience of seeing you know, these faces coming to me as if out of the jungle that had hid them, and now becoming these human beings who were cherished and whose lives, if they'd been cut short during the war, would have you know, been tragic for them and their families, but also tragic in general for humanity, because they both contributed in their work, in their art, so much. And you know, who knows how many people were wasted in that way? How many precious lives were lost in that way? But, you know, seeing their humanity, their human faces, which is what I strongly feel that you know, good literature, good film, good stories, etc., should do. You know, should show us each other's humanity. Should dissolve the borders between us. It did become a motivation for me, you know, very, very strongly to pursue this work.
Now, I've seen it in a lot of your work, all through your work, and also I think I see it in your work that's even not about the war in Vietnam, the work you've written about Israel and Palestine, the work you've written about your experiences there, the work you've written about where you live in Southern Maryland, bringing in the cultures and histories of African Americans and Native Americans, and not just the story that we usually tell. I mean, you try to go underneath these things to kind of bring that kind of reality to people in ways that make you feel for all of us and everything.
I think that dissolution of the borders between us, you know, that need we have to be able to walk in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through their eyes. You know, when we don't do that, I mean, I've, obviously I experience the ultimate that becomes, which is war, you know, when you kill each other because of the differences. But in what you're bringing up, Mark, in the sense that this kind of permeates the rest of my work, it's the thing you take out of war, but it connects to everything. It connects to the ways we regard each other as human beings or don't regard each other as human beings. So it can be in a jungle in Vietnam. It can be in a highway where a black man's raising his hands and somebody's only seeing him as a as I would have seen those people in the war, as a threat, as a target.
Well, Wayne, I'm looking forward to November when we have a chance to have a really long conversation together about your work, about the latest work you're doing, about the other work that you've done. Play some of our Wandering Souls that we did together in Vietnam. Wayne Carlin is one, I think, of America's most outstanding authors, who was a Marine in Vietnam, helicopter gunner, that changed his life, and especially when he began to meet the Vietnamese that he fought against in those years during the Vietnam War. And has written some amazing books. Wandering Souls is one of the books he'll be talking about this Friday evening, September 23rd, from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Baltimore Book Festival. He'll be at the Ivy Bookshop stage, which will be one of the major event locations. And my brother, it's always good to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you soon and getting you back on the air with us for a much longer conversation. I want to thank you for all you do to open our hearts through our wounds to heal again. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark. Let me add one thing that the hour before me at the Ivy Bookstore, there's a combat veteran from the Iraq War speaking about his work, I haven't met him yet. But
oh, cool!
Now the Ivy Bookstore is doing that. You know, first him, and then my presentation. So
that should be a great evening and afternoon.
All right, Wayne. All right, brother. Good talking to you. Take care.
Always, Wayne. Always. Take care, brother. Yeah, Wayne Carlin, catch him this Friday night, 5 to 6 p.m., the Ivy Bookshop stage of the Baltimore Book Festival. We're going to take a 10-second break and come right back, and we meet Jordan Camp, who's also going to be at the book festival. We're now going to talk to Jordan Camp, who co-edited the book Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. He'll be at the Baltimore Book Festival as well. He'll be speaking on Sunday, September the 25th, from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion. And Jordan, welcome. Good to have you with us on the program.
Oh, thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate you having me.
And I look forward to actually getting you as well here, along with some of the other authors of your book. Let's talk about this book. I mean, this is a book you edited with a number of activists and researchers and scholars reflect and artists talking about this particular issue. And you have Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, and Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Robin Kelly. I mean, amazing group of people who are writing this book. So talk a bit about this book.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. The volume Policing the Planet that I co-edited with Christina Heatherton is an effort to name the form of policing, which is otherwise known as broken windows policing or zero tolerance policing, that's at the root of so much social unrest in the country, from Ferguson to Baltimore after Freddie Gray's murder, New York City after Eric Garner was choked to death. And what we wanted to do was show the origins and the development of that policy and the ways in which activists such as the ones you named, as well as others like Pete White and the Los Angeles Community Action Network or the Red Nation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, have organized themselves to confront this policing practice. And we want to link that to the essays and articles of a number of scholars working on these questions. And the idea is to provide an intervention that would not only be useful in the classroom, but something that the public, activists, and ordinary people may find useful.
I mean, I think one of the things you do here is in this book, through the different series of essays, is also kind of talk about the roots of this. How do we come to a place where this is the norm in America, whether it's our schools or our streets, and why it happened?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, sometimes when we focus on these spectacular instances or dramatic events, we miss the ways in which there's a routine in everyday surveillance and policing and the targeting of essentially non-criminal behavior that's led to, and the United States, after all, incarcerates more of its citizens than any other country in the world. We have the largest carceral state on the planet. And what we're trying to do is to say that this is an outgrowth of shifts in politics and economics over the last 30 years. And so on Sunday at 3 p.m., my co-editor and I will be in dialogue with someone who I know is a guest on your program often, Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University, who did a great book called Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. And we'll investigate where there's an overlap in our concern about racism, about policing, about poverty in cities, and Professor Spence's analysis of neoliberalism. And so the book really does try to look at the roots in these public policies that have taken hold over the last few decades.
I mean, some of the things that you do in your book, and it's really fascinating, and I've only had a chance to kind of go through it quickly, and I really, really want to get into it in a deeper way, you cross a lot of boundaries here. I mean, you talk about the anti-Indianism and police strategies in New Mexico. You talk about the stuff that most people don't know about, how L.A. Skid Row played into police practices that are commonplace today. Everything from that to the influence of Israeli policing on certain police forces. I mean, you really get into the heart and depth of where this came from, but also have artists talking about this, so it's not just policy people.
That's right, exactly. Well, we in Policing the Planet, while the policing crisis led to Black Lives Matter, we tried to think things that are traditionally thought apart. So, you know, we think that the problem of black poverty in cities and the criminalization of homelessness is somehow disconnected from the demonization and criminalization of low-income or no-income Native communities. But what we see in Albuquerque and L.A. are deep connections, or the connections between mass incarceration and mass deportation. I mean, after all, we live in an era where there's been more people, you know, deported under the Obama administration than any other administration. We wanted to connect the counterterrorism and war on terror policies that are developed for, you know, battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan, the development of predictive, what they call predictive policing in cities, and the kind of surveillance that are being implemented in the poorest, particularly the poorest communities of color in the United States. And so this is to make vivid, we think, that this policing crisis is systemic. It's structural. It connects, you know, the plight and the struggles of Latino communities, of Native American communities, of African American communities, and that this problem of police and state violence, you know, affects poor communities of color in general, and so it will require a unified response. And that's what the contributors to our volume really try to, emphasize.
So I'm curious. I mean, I know you knew a lot of this before you started editing the book, but I'm curious what you came to in this book that was unexpected for you in terms of your own understanding of where this comes from and why we're here.
Well, you know, when we started this book in the spring of 2014, it was before Mike Brown was killed and the Ferguson uprising happened, before we saw this circulation and expansion of Black Lives Matter in cities around the U.S. and around the world. And I think one of the things that's been surprising for me, though I remain, you know, pessimistic about the some prospects for change, given the overwhelming and persistence of police violence, of everyday criminalization. On the other hand, there's a whole new generation of young people, from Black Youth Project 100 to Communities United for Police Reform to the Red Nation, and what they've shown me, and I think inspired me and a whole generation, really, is not to accept this outcome as inevitable. They've shown us that alternative futures are not only possible and I think very necessary. So I hope your listeners will consider, buying a copy of the book, Policing the Planet. You can get it from Verso. They're running sales. You know, you can get it for less than $15. There's interviews. There's essays. And I think there's some optimism and some vision and some strategy to help us, you know, think the problems that we're up against in a systemic way. And that's, you know, that's been encouraging.
And I think that it'll be a great discussion between the two of you. And I do encourage people to take part in this. And I think that given the DOJ report that's the consent decree that's being negotiated here in Baltimore right now, to think about what just happened with Terrence Crutch and in Tulsa and Keith Scott in North Carolina. So this is a time for this discussion. It's really an incredible book that I'm only now working my way through and really looking forward to going through it and doing a program with these folks about it. Jordan Camp, co-edited Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. He and Lester Spence will be at the Baltimore Book Festival on Sunday, September the 25th, from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion. So you can go take part in that. It should be a great discussion. Jordan, great to talk to you briefly. I look forward to talking to you some more.
Thanks so much, Mark, and I'd be delighted to talk anytime.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, now it's time to take a switch. Time for Baltimore City Paper. It will take, give us 10 seconds. We'll be right back with Baynard Woods. Baynard Woods, reporter for The Guardian and editor-at-large of the City Paper, is at City Paper Time on The Steiner Show. Bay, how you doing?
Doing great, Mark. How about you?
I'm good.
Feels like old times.
I know. What are you doing there? So, Bay, talk a bit about you did the cover story.
I didn't do the cover story about, it's a great cover story by Fire Angelou about the slam poetry scene in Baltimore right now.
Oh, no, Kia Brown did the story. I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah, and it's a spectacular story with profiles sort of some of the city's and also great portraits of some of the city's best slam poets. And so if that's something that people sort of want to know about, it's a great introduction to the scene and to what's going on with that. So I can't speak highly enough about that, and I wish I would have written it, but it that was not me. What I did write was a review of a biography of Jane Jacobs, the great urban theorist.
Right.
And it was, you know, I'm a big fan of Jacobs, so I was really excited to review the book, and I was left extremely underwhelmed by it. It's by Robert Cannigal, who's a local guy, so I also wanted to like it, but I have to say it was rather dreadful when in the first several pages, within the first 100 pages, there were several long passages talking about how ugly she was.
Really?
Calling her fat and dumpy, to use a direct quote.
Oh, my God.
It's just like, what? And it was hard to, he then just, yeah, the, it just never got much better than that.
That's really too bad.
Yeah, it is, because, I mean, everything, every time I walk down the street in this city, everything that I love about the city can remind you, if you've recently read The Death and Life of Great American Cities, can remind you of Jane Jacobs. And so to have a biography coming from Baltimore would be really spectacular. And there are these great little hints of some thoughts that she had on urban renewal schemes and stuff like that in Baltimore. So, you know, with Port Covington and stuff, and gentrification, it could be essential for us right now to think through these problems. And this book didn't help, however.
That's too bad. When I first heard it, I hadn't read it yet. I was hoping that it was going to be a really great book and that be something to get into, but I guess not. Did you read the review of the Adnan story by Rabia Chowdhury?
Yeah, so, there's an interesting review of Rabia Chowdhury's book, Adnan's Story. It sort of goes through the, you know, anyone who covered that story, as I did when he was getting when they were having the post-conviction motions for the retrial, I got to know Rabia pretty well, or anyone who's followed it. She was the one who first brought the story to Sarah Koenig for Serial. She then worked with the Undisclosed podcast people, and has been a fierce champion for Adnan for a long time. And as the Susan review of it sort of concludes, that it often feels unwieldy and the prose overwrought, but Chowdhury's book will appeal to Serial fans because of its fascinating store of information. You know how obsessed people sort of are with all of the details of that case. And so the book, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm looking forward to reading it.
There are a number of books here that that look really interesting, and I know that there were also Karen did a review, another a local author, Makita Brotman's book on the book club and maximum security, called Maximum Security Book Club. That looked like that. I don't know if you read that one or not.
Yeah, and I mean, as it happens, I have a cameo in the book, weirdly.
Aha! What are you doing in that book?
While she's doing the book club, I went and did a cover story for City Paper on the book club.
Uh-huh.
And I quoted an inmate saying something that I can't say on the air about a part of female anatomy that he misses while in prison. And that ended up causing a great uproar within the community, and one of the inmates who sort of arranged the book club was super mad about the whole thing, and he's now out. And so he and I were on a panel with Makita a couple of weeks ago, and he sort of confronted me about that. I didn't realize what problems it would cause them, and it turned out not causing problems immediately. However, there's a news story beside it that Makita's class has recently been suspended by Jessup, and she's no longer allowed to teach that class there.
Really?
They alleged that there were, it seems like some kind, they said that in the book there was evidence of some kind of impropriety of her being too close of friends with the prisoners. And so it's a great book. It's really fascinating. It's part literary criticism, part stories of these men's life, part stories about what literature means and in different contexts. She thought that they might sympathize with Humbert Humbert, the narrator of Lolita, when they read that, and they all just saw him as a horrible, gross pedophile and had zero sympathy for him at all, whereas as Makita, being in a different world, had a great deal of sympathy for him.
That's really interesting. No, I remember hearing about that. But also, I'm not shocked that that the kind of puritanical rulers of our prison system would ban her from teaching.
Yeah, unfortunately, me either.
So what I was looking on the website is John Waters' Kitty Flamingos, is that in this issue too, or is that just on the web?
Well, that's just on the web. There is a blurb for it because it's coming up. I was just looking at that myself. Which seems really fascinating. So that's going to be on September 21st at the BMA. And, yeah, I mean, he's remaking Pink Flamingos or acting Pink Flamingos with kids. It's kind of, he's done it before back in early 2015, but it's something that seems crazily sort of perfectly John Waters.
So is there anything else in the sheet that grabs you that we should know about before we...
Well, Ed Erickson has a really good story about a woman who is a recovering addict and sort of what she's doing in the community and the ways that it's one of those things that I sort of like most out of City Paper, a profile of someone who's you know, an ordinary person with a sort of extraordinary story, and so she is now back in school, and it's a really nice, you know, profile of an everyday person that I think we don't get enough of in news stories.
Well, you see, one of the things I've come to realize, all these who are doing this work and just of life period, but especially doing this work for the last 24 years almost, is the extraordinary lives of ordinary people is an everyday occurrence. We just have to open our eyes and hear the voices.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. That's everywhere.
Baynard Woods, always good to talk to you, brother. We'll see each other soon, I hope.
All right. Definitely, Mark. Thanks a million.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening and being part of the show today here on The Mark Steiner Show. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.